Nate Hedgie didn't first encounter the northern Great Plains as a reporter. Eventually, he would cover the region and the stories playing out there, but his first experience with the place was driving cross-country with his dad in the family station wagon when he was 4. His impression of the Great Plains then was the same he would have later, the same as settlers who tried to make a living on that land. The plains were scary and overwhelming.
This area that I was working in, northeastern Montana, was one of the last places to be homesteaded in the lower 48. The flatness out there, for me, was terrifying. And I think it was terrifying for a lot of people who first came out there. Endless sky, a flat sea of grass. God country, overwhelming.
On every hand, the treeless plain stretches away to the horizon line.
1 mile of it is almost exactly like another. No brooks babble under icy armor.
There is no bird life.
The silence of death rests on the vast landscape, save when it is swept by cruel winds that search out every chink and cranny of the buildings.
An alarming amount of insanity occurs in the new prairie states among farmers and their wives.
Prairie madness.
That term comes from an Atlantic writer back in the 1890s. Insane asylums filling with Scandinavians come off the Great Plains.
These people came from cheery little farm villages.
Life in the fatherland was hard and toilsome. It was not lonesome.
You've been promised that this area that you're going to is going to be so easy to farm. It's going to be just like home. You're rolling out there on this hot, slow-moving train, and it's just unfolding in front of you, your future, and it's not what you dreamed it to be. It's empty.
Think for a moment how great the change must be from the white-walled, red-roofed village on a Norway fjord, with its church and schoolhouse, its fishing boats on the blue inlet, and its green mountain walls towering aloft, to snowfields on a prairie.
Is it any wonder that so many Scandinavians lose their mental balance?
For people who came from these really tight communities to be spread out across the Great Plains, trying to grow crops in a place that is really tough to grow crops, trying to raise cattle in a place that rejects you and rejects what you're trying to do, it broke a lot of people. It broke their wallets, their minds. After World War I, this homesteading boom that was happening in northeastern Montana essentially collapsed. People have been slowly filtering out of this area of the Great Plains ever since.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the past 5 months, Nate Hedgie has been working on a story about the future of that huge swath of land, emptied of people and emptied mostly of wild animals. Nate is KUER's reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, and his story is about this effort by a group of very wealthy investors to create a wildlife conservation area on those plains. Think of it as a very big national park, one that's open and free to the public. But here's the twist. It's private. That is, it's not operated and regulated by the federal government or by state government. These investors don't think the government can actually properly preserve this land. The idea is to rewild the place, to return the animals that had been wiped out by white settlers, which means bison, of course, but also wolves and grizzly bears. Nate is joining us today to talk about this project. It's called the American Prairie Reserve. And he told us, of all the issues of the West, it's on these plains that the most intense and forgotten stories are playing out.
When I was a reporter in Montana, I was based in Bozeman for about a year. And there's a lot of issues happening there. I wasn't interested in those issues. I really felt like everything that I wanted to tell, the stories I wanted to tell, were out in eastern Montana. There is a character there that you don't see in the rest of the country, an old part of our character with ranching, farming. There's racism out there, especially along the border towns. There's a lot of reservations. And so those border towns and those areas, you see a lot of racism between white folk and the Ani and the Coda and folks who are living in Fort Peck. And so there's a lot of tension there. And the history is just laid bare on the land. You see broken down homesteading shacks and teepee rings and fire scars. It's just all right there, and it's so present. Even that racism I was talking about is just completely – you're so connected to history, I guess. Yeah. The genocide that we perpetrated against indigenous people in this country is – it's a fresh memory out there, and it's very raw. And I think that's what I'm attracted to about telling stories out there, is the rawness of that country.
You said there's a kind of honesty there.
Yeah, there is a kind of honesty. People are also really nice. I mean, I'm talking about all this tension and this conflict, but folks are also really nice. It's the kind of place where the roads out there are terrible.
Right.
I think I describe them as driving on bacon grease
yeah.
And when it rains. And at first, when you're first out there, you're kind of terrified because if it rains and you're stuck, no one's going to come to your help. But people do come to your help, and you soon realize that it's this one, it's a big spread out neighborhood, and folks are always willing to help you, and they're willing to talk with you. They're willing to say, I disagree with everything you stand for, but you seem like a nice guy, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of honesty, I think there's a civility, maybe that's the word. There's a civility out there as well.
So when did this idea of the American Prairie Reserve, when did this come to you? When did you learn about this?
I heard about it in graduate school. And I remember I was...
So you've been thinking about this for a while.
Long time. Yeah. I was not paying attention in class. And I saw a slide. And I don't know what the slide was about, but it said American Prairie Reserve. And I was like, that sounds crazy. American Prairie Reserve. Wow. What is that? And there was a picture of a bison. And I heard that it was this rewilding project out in the Great Plains, you know, that was privately funded. Just all sorts of things start flowing in your imagination about what this thing could be. And then when I was in Montana, I was doing stories about it, just little stories. But it was one of those ones where you do it, you know, and it just kind of haunts you. And you're like, man, if there was ever a moment where I could do a big story about this, I want to. Because I really think that all the conflicts we're seeing in the American West are playing out right here.
In that story.
In that story, yeah.
So what is it? Just like explain what it is. It's this new kind of national park.
Right. And not a national park like we think of as Yellowstone or Yosemite, something that's ran by the federal government. This is privately funded. Free to the public. You can hunt there. It's a patchwork of private and public lands.
Yeah.
So it's actually mostly owned by the federal government. But what this group is doing is they're buying these private ranches that are in this space, this 3.2 million acre proposed reserve. They're buying these.
How big is that, by the way? Just put that in perspective.
3.2 million acres is roughly the same size as Connecticut. It's larger than the Serengeti National Park in Tanzania.
Wow.
It's, I think, bigger than Yellowstone and Yosemite combined. It's massive.
Yeah.
It takes hours to drive across. That was something that really surprised me. And it has to be that big, scientists say, in order to be able to support this huge ecosystem. A place where you have thousands of wild bison, grizzly bears, wolves, all the animals you'd see in Yellowstone National Park, but without the millions of tourists. So their dream is really, really grand and really big.
So it seems like this proposal, this story, raises all of these really big questions, and that seems like a lot of anxiety. Like, what does it mean if this is private and not run by the government. Like, if there isn't government regulation there, if there isn't some kind of law to protect land forever, like, it's really toying with our ideas that we've all, in the West anyway, come to expect about the relationship between land and the government.
Right. So we have a lot of public land out here.
Yeah.
And when we go out to public land, you know, it's owned by the federal government or it's owned by the state government. And again, American Prairie Reserve is going to have large chunks of federally managed land.
Right.
But there's also going to be big chunks of privately owned land.
Yeah.
And American Prairie is not giving that land back to the federal government. And that does, as you said, raise all sorts of crazy questions about, well, what happens, you know, if American Prairie Reserve fails? And is this land just sold off to the highest bidder? Or what happens if they decide to do something crazy on that land?
Yeah.
You know, we have no say. And that's kind of something that a lot of critics are concerned about with groups like this that do these social goods programs, you know, whether it's building a new kind of national park or, you know, trying to prevent malaria through some health program. If we don't like what they're doing, we can't vote them out of office.
Yeah.
You know, they get to have final say. We can write letters and we can complain just like we do to Walmart, you know, but that's about it.
Well, and it's also this question about the economy and capitalism in general, that it has its own kind of inertia, that in the end, will there be some economic, you know, reality that means they sell that land off, that they get rid of that land, that in the end, the market will move in and won't protect this place.
Absolutely. That was a fear I had when I was first reporting this story. A fear I should say I heard from a lot of people is what happens? And so American Prairie Reserve has in their bylaws, essentially, if they fail, they have to give their land, either sell it or give it, to a similar-minded charitable organization, which means something like the Nature Conservancy or, you know, another version of American Prairie Reserve. So that land will always be protected, which is great if you're an environmentalist or a conservationist. That's awesome. But if you're a rancher, that means most likely you'll never own that land again. That land will no longer be ranch land. It's going to be rewilded.
Let's talk about what you mean about rewilding, because that's the larger goal here. And there's this really interesting moment where you're talking to he's like the pitchman for the American Prairie Reserve, Sean Garrity. And he's on this hill with you, and he's looking down at the valley below, and he's kind of pointing out this tableau that he has in his mind of what this is going to look like.
Yeah, yeah. We're standing on this big hill. It's a place that he always takes reporters. It's like the prettiest part of American Prairie Reserve.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he's doing. And he takes me up there. And it does. It looks like a miniature Grand Canyon, you know, with the wide, muddy Missouri River flowing through and these big white canyons. And he's like, over there, there'll be some grizzly bears. Over here, you'll see some bison, you know. Up there, you're going to see some bighorn sheep. I think at one point he says, you know, this valley that we're looking at is twice the size of Lamar Valley in Yellowstone National Park. That's one of the most popular valleys you can go to. And if he has his way, all the wildlife that you'd see at Yellowstone will be out here on this tableau, this valley. And not just there, but all across this 3.2 million acre preserve.
The expanse of it, the scale of it is the point, right? I mean, that's the idea. In order to have an ecosystem that can support this many creatures, it has to be
to be at least 3.2 million acres. That's according to scientists from the World Wildlife Fund. They wrote this landmark study. It's called Oceans of Grass. And it laid out, if we want to protect grasslands in the world, those are some of the most underrepresented, overlooked ecosystems in the world. There's only four remaining big grasslands left on Earth, and the Northern Great Plains has some of them, specifically this area, the Missouri River Break. So they pointed there and they said that would be a pretty good spot to, if you were to create this big wildlife sanctuary, this big nature preserve. But it's got to be really big. It's got to be 3.2 million acres, because that's what's going to be able to sustain a genetically happy, healthy herd of wild bison, as well as wolves and grizzly bears and all the other animals you'd want to see.
You mentioned in the piece that local ranching families see this as an existential threat. That's how you put it in the piece. Explain what that means, because in this vision that Sean Garrity is showing you, it doesn't include livestock, and it doesn't seem to take into account ranching.
Yeah, there's a little bit of nuance there. It doesn't include livestock. Or if it does include livestock, it includes a vision where cowboys are once again running cattle on the open range. It does not include modern ranching. And so that's in direct conflict with the way ranchers have viewed that land for over 150 years and worked that land for over 150 years. They see land as something to produce food or fuel from.
Yeah.
You got to work that land.
Yeah.
And as I found in my piece, it's a very Christian notion of man as steward. And that fuels ranching and farming communities in this part of the world, is that idea that man is in control. And essentially what American Prairie wants is nature to be in control.
Yeah.
And those two paradigms are at odds.
It gets us to another character in the piece, Connie French and her husband, Craig.
Yeah.
And there's this moment I wanted to ask you about. We'll talk a little bit more about Connie in a moment, but Craig says this thing that's really interesting about wild animals on a prairie.
That, to me, is like telling a teenager, just go do as you please without any boundaries, and that's definitely not a way to parent, and letting animals roam free and do as they please is definitely not a way, in my view, to steward land. That would be going backwards as far as conservation.
Wasn't that the way that it was before? I mean, like, you know, before homesteaders and everybody else came here, that was exactly that. The teenagers were running free for time immemorial, and those animals were living alongside each other. And
on a grander scale, though, from here to way down there. When God was doing it, he had a lot bigger playground. We just have this small little sandbox.
His concern is that these animals are going to overgraze areas. They're going to disrupt the ecosystem, and that they need someone moving these animals around, just like you would move cattle. And so he kind of compares them to teenagers, and teenagers need a parent, you know, to help them. Points to Ted Turner. Ted Turner has a big buffalo ranch, and he has guys who run those buffalo, and they manage them like cattle, and they sell them. And I think the ranchers would much rather see that happening on this landscape. Scientists say otherwise. They say that 3.2 million acres will be big enough, but they also don't live on that land every day, you know? And Connie and Craig wake up every morning on that land, and they feel that they know how best to protect it and how best to manage it.
Nate Hedgie, he's KUER's reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. We're talking about his radio documentary series, The Next Yellowstone, which you can find at KUER.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale, host of the Preach podcast. This week, my guest is Sister Helen Prejean.
Oh, faith. Faith is like a rolling wave. It's like riding a river. It flows. Even as a child, I had that thirst.
We talk forbidden love, activism, and Sister Helen's more than 60 years as a Catholic nun. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the American Prairie Reserve. It's a new kind of national park, 3.2 million acres of land in northeastern Montana, and it's funded by a group of wealthy investors. These are people who have lost faith in the federal government's ability to save America's wildlands. Nate Hedgie is our guest. He's KUER's reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. His radio documentary is called The Next Yellowstone. Let's talk about Danny Kinka. He's one of the scientist, one of the biologists who's thinking about this, and he is he talked to you about the possibility of repopulating the prairie with wildlife. Say a little bit more about what this place did look like a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, so Danny describes it best. And so we're driving, and he is just getting really excited about explaining what this country used to look like. Because right now, it's grasses and some birds and maybe a couple of deer. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll see a pronghorn antelope. But when Lewis and Clark, the explorers Lewis and Clark, came through this area, they describe a scene of just thousands of a plains blanketed by bison and wolves and grizzly bears and herds of antelope. We wiped that out so fast. It was within 30 years, I think, 30, 40 years that we cleaned the grasslands of most of the big, big wildlife out there. But back then, it was supposedly a stunning scene.
Lewis and Clark describe a scene of hardly being able to look in any direction without seeing vast, uncountable herds of wildlife. So if the place feels empty, I think there's a reason for that. There's something missing. This is a blank canvas upon which is supposed to be painted some of the most interesting and incredible animals that have ever walked the continent.
So Kink is excited about seeing something like that again.
Yeah. I mean, that's why he took the job.
Yeah.
You can take a job. So Kinka is a wildlife ecologist, and he could take a job, you know, at a university or as a professor or for the government. But he was really attracted by working for a private foundation, something that had vision, in his words, where you could actually get stuff done. Hmm. And he gets to be at the cutting edge of rewilding this place and turning back the clock somewhat to what it used to look like. Obviously, there'll be more people there, and you know, a lot of things have changed in the 150, 200 years since the prairies were full of animals. But the chance for him to have that power and just to get stuff done, it was just, I mean, he couldn't think of a better job.
But what does he mean, repopulate a place with wildlife? I mean, how do you do that? Do you go and get them and put them there? Do you just free up the space and wait for them to arrive?
Right. Yeah. As another APR employee told me, he's like, I'm worried that people are going to think that we're just, you know, carrying two grizzly bears underneath our arms and walking out to the Great Plains.
Yeah.
It's way more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And again, it's because state and federal agencies own wildlife. Private companies don't own wildlife. Private people don't own wildlife. It's just not how this country works.
But federal agencies own wildlife.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Taxpayers own the wildlife. They manage the wildlife.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
Maybe they'd be a little bit peeved if I said own. They manage the wildlife. They're in control of the wildlife.
Yeah.
With the exception of bison. That's a whole other tricky, tricky thing.
Yeah.
So essentially what American Prairie Reserve is doing is they are bison in Montana. This gets a little complicated, but bison in Montana are considered livestock. It's weird. It's like a loophole. It's a weird wrinkle in the law. And so American Prairie Reserve is actually able to buy bison and then put them onto their lands and onto their lands that they have grazing leases on and essentially repopulate this area with bison. Other wildlife, grizzly bears, wolves, you can't buy them.
Yes.
But these animals are slowly migrating back to the Great Plains on their own. A lot of people don't know that grizzly bears were a Great Plains animal.
Yeah.
You know, and those big claws that they have aren't for ripping up people's faces and things like that, but they're for digging up in the dirt and getting little worms and things like that. I mean, they are a Great Plains animal that hightailed it up to the mountains when white settlers came. And so now they are slowly creeping back to that area. So there's nothing they really have to do except create a home. It's like creating a big home and inviting all these animals in and saying, hey, doors are open. This is a safe space for you. Come on. Come on back.
Let's talk more about Sean Garrity. He's the founder of American Prairie Reserve. And you mentioned in your story that he has always seen something more in those plains than just the drab and the boring. He also has a kind of a connection to the place.
He does. So he's an ex-Silicon Valley entrepreneur. Made his money as a consultant for big companies like Apple and AT&T. But he was born and raised in central Montana in a little town called Great Falls, which, if you've ever been to Great Falls, is a rough and tumble, windy plains town right off the Rocky Mountain front. And so his dad was a hunter. His mom was into camping and hiking. And so that's what he did growing up. It's hard to find a job in Montana. And so after he graduated from Bozeman, he took off out west, made his money, came back, wanted to raise his family. That's where he first heard about this idea of rewilding the West. And as we said, it's been around for a long time. But
he's the one that starts to give it structure, starts putting together the idea, starts pitching and raising donation.
Right. He took that business mindset of Silicon Valley and placed it into the middle of the Great Plains. That bothered a lot of people. But it also got stuff done. And so, yeah, his idea was federal government doesn't have the budget or the political will to build something like this, but private enterprise does. And so for the past 18 years, he and his team have been flying all over the world trying to squeeze money from some of the wealthiest philanthropists in the world.
Is there a political ideology associated with this that are these – like, are they conservatives? Are they libertarian in their view? I mean, there's a suspicion of the federal government, which makes me wonder, what are the politics here, if there are any?
All over the board.
Is that right?
Yeah. If you were to talk to someone like Kinka, I don't think he'd describe himself as a conservative. Probably, you know, as progressive as any guy his age who's a biologist.
Yeah.
If you talk to Sean Garrity, I imagine that he's not conservative. If you talk to some of their donors, though, yeah, definitely. Conservative, fiscally conservative. I think they all share a distrust of the federal government or a belief that the federal government isn't getting stuff done. So it's a weird thing where these different political persuasions are all kind of coming together with a shared belief that, like, hey, maybe private enterprise is the way to do this. And I should say, too, that their managing director used to work for a political think tank that was funded by the Koch brothers and very, very much into finding private solutions for environmental causes. It's a whole paradigm called free market environmentalism. Yeah.
It's such a weird conflict going on there, right? I mean, on one hand, you have people – and there are a number of these you mentioned in your piece, a number of principals from – who have been involved in oil and gas companies and extractive industries who are on the one hand – you know, they've been involved in that very profitable business, but on the other hand, have been involved in setting aside land or doing environmental projects.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So two of the reserve's most prominent donors worked in the finance industry, helping steer major investments in oil, gas, or coal. You know, these industries have exacerbated climate change, which has caused wildfires, floods, droughts in the northern Great Plains. So critics would say, like, there's a lot of hypocrisy here,
yeah,
as you were saying. But Garrity then threw it back at me, kind of threw it right back at my face and was like, well, you just drove 2,000 miles in your 99 Toyota Tacoma up here to tell this story. You burned gallons and gallons of gas. How are you less culpable in the degradation of the environment as these guys are? He said the consumer, the person who serves on the board of an oil company is just as evil as the consumer or as the person who ravenously consumes the product, is the way he put it. And it gave me a lot to think about. It's a really interesting dilemma. And, you know, we're all culpable in environmental degradation. And if he was to cut everybody out, you know, that means he cuts most of his really wealthy donors out. He cuts the people who just give $25, $50 a year out. He loses everyone, and then this pocket of the Great Plains doesn't get saved.
But I have to say, it does make you feel a little suspicious of – I'm not sure how to feel about a group of elites buying up all of this land. And there is some – you know, this is one of the things you mentioned in the story, that there is some suspicion up there that this is just going to be kind of a playground for wealthy people, and that the elites are the ones that are going to be somehow advantaged in all of this.
Right. It doesn't help that they've got these really high-end yurts there that, you know, called the Kestrel Camp that you can stay in. And that some of their donors and most of their board members are super, super, super rich people. We're talking heirs to the Mars Candy Company, German billionaire, New York City-based investment bankers. And so, yeah, there's a lot of concern up there that this is just going to be a playground for the wealthy. But also, here's the thing. American Prairie Reserve's mission is to create a park for the people. It's free to the public. It's a legacy project for these people. It isn't just some playground they can go to. If they really wanted a playground, you can be like the Wilkes brothers or somebody else and just buy a house on a big spread and visit there a couple times a year with your family. This is something more for them. As the board chairman, George Matulich, said, you know, who wouldn't want to be on the ground floor of Yellowstone National Park? Who wouldn't want to be right there when it begins? You know, these guys' names won't be remembered in 100 years, but their hope is that the thing they created will be remembered for a long, long time, much longer than a Silicon Valley company or some, you know, investment firm that you worked for. So that's what I really think it's about for them. It's legacy.
Yeah. Well, and you do mention that there's an important history of the mega wealthy setting aside land in this country. Rockefeller comes to mind right away, setting aside the land for the Grand Tetons.
Right, exactly. He bought land that would eventually become a part of Grand Teton. And just like with American Prairie, cattlemen threw a fit. They had a protest ride.
It's like the same kind of fight played
out
then. Yeah,
exactly. There was a protest ride, and they compared them to a bunch of Nazis. This, by the way, it was in 1943. 2 years after Pearl Harbor, and they compared it to the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor when this news broke out.
Wow.
That's like in 2003 comparing something to 9/11. I mean, that's how much rage and anger there were. But Grand Teton is now one of the most popular parks in the country, and it'd be hard-pressed to find people that don't think it was a good idea.
Can you tell when you go to that area that there's a fight going on? Like if you drive around, can you see signs of it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally signs.
Literally signs, yeah.
There are signs that say, save the cowboy, stop the American Prairie Reserve, don't buffalo me, things like that everywhere. They're tacked to sheds. They're in yards. There's one looking down from a building in this town of Lewistown. And it looks right down to where American Prairie's visitor center is kind of headquartered. I mean, you see them everywhere. There's a concerted campaign to showcase opposition against the project.
And if you're a reporter nosing around about all of this, how do they treat you? Are people willing to talk?
Yeah, they're willing to talk about how much they don't like American Prairie Reserve. They're not willing to talk about on record about whether they do like it. And so I think I heard somewhere that about 2/3 of the folks out there don't like the reserve. That means a third of the locals either have no feelings about it or maybe they do like it. And I remember I ran into people, you know, who'd be like, well— at least they're not the Wilkes brothers. The Wilkes brothers being these really, really rich brothers who made their money in the fracking industry. And they close off public access, sometimes with armed guards.
Wow.
And so American Prairie Reserve is at least keeping those lands open to the public. And so better them than some other rich, wealthy out-of-stater. But they would never talk to me on record because ranching is super powerful business and you don't cross party lines.
Tell us about Connie French.
Connie French is, I describe her in the story as, she doesn't look like a stereotypical rancher. She's this, she looks like someone's artsy grandmother, you know?
Yeah.
You could, but instead of putzing around her backyard garden, she's driving ATVs and rounding up hundreds of cattle. She's just a total awesome, like just a really, she's a really strong-willed woman. And it was really important for me in this story. I didn't want your typical male perspective of a rancher. I wanted to talk to a woman, in part because that land, a lot of the settlers when they first came were women. You know, there was a big chunk. I think it was like something like 20 or 30% of them were single women. And so Connie French obviously isn't single, but I wanted to hear her perspective. And she loves the land, wakes up every morning. You know, she works the cattle. She takes care of horse with a broken leg in the middle of the winter at night, freezing temperatures, is out there with the bugs and the heat every day in the summer. And she, the way she says it, she's It's like skydiving for her, that self-sufficiency, you know, knowing that you can handle whatever gets thrown at you. But American Prairie Reserve is a totally different beast for her. You know, she sees them as coming in and buying up the land and not listening to the people who live there every day. She sees them as an affront, as a threat to her very way of life and her culture.
You say in the piece that most ranchers have, in fact, done a good job of caring for the land, that they are, using their term, pretty good stewards.
Yeah, there's a reason why this is one of the last intact grassland ecosystems in the world. I don't want to paint ranchers with a broad brush. Obviously, a lot of folks will overgraze the land or do poor things to it. But out here, they've done a pretty good job, partially because it's not a great place to have crops, so you're not plowing up a ton of land. But if you work your cattle right and you graze them properly, you can make the land look pretty. And they're powerful conservation groups that work with ranchers out there, including the Nature Conservancy, to help steward it and to protect native grassland, bring back a lot of the animals that we used to see. So they are doing a good job.
But this seems like a pretty basic impasse here. If you've got ranchers who are caring for the land in some ways, and yet an idea that doesn't take into account conventional ranching anyway. I mean, that's an impasse. I don't see how you resolve that.
You don't.
Yeah.
I don't think you do. I think you can resolve it on your borders. I think that they're doing a good job. Or, I mean, I think that they're doing – that's something that American Prairie Reserve is working really hard towards doing, is essentially having ranchers on their borders that are friendly and are allowing animals to move in and out of the reserve. But at the end of the day, they have to buy – 80 properties in order to build this thing. And you could have, you know, a couple ranchers here and there, but that's an impasse between wanting to work the land and having man in control versus nature in control.
Right. There are some real recreational opportunities for the economy here. And this is one of the things you get at in the piece. Introduce us to Justin Schaff.
So Justin's this 27-year-old guy. He looks like a high school linebacker. He's kind of got a scrubby beard, and he is a hunter, and he sees American Prairie Reserve as potentially helping save the eastern Montana, because eastern Montana has been bleeding population ever since that homesteading boom busted.
Yeah.
Ranching, while it's a powerhouse there, hasn't done much to stymie that flow. Agricultural jobs have dropped by a third since 1970. Wages are below the national average. He thinks that maybe a shot of tourism could help keep people there. And then he points to himself. And he's like, I could go somewhere else and make more money. But I stay here because of all these wild places in my backyard. And there is a study from Headwaters Economics that shows that so-called recreation counties, especially rural recreation counties, places that you get lots of, you have lots of camping, hiking, fishing, things like that, they're doing better economically than counties without those amenities. And so if you look at it through that lens, maybe American Prairie Reserve would offer that shot of tourism. That said, could I see a family from the Midwest driving their minivan out to see the next Yellowstone with those kind of roads, how empty it is, 100 miles away from the interstate? No. But could I see hunters going out there? Or people who love to go to places like Escalante, you know, it's pretty wild and rugged, and going out there and getting lost? Absolutely.
Why? It's interesting that they don't allow ranching in the reserve, but they will allow hunting. How is that not a kind of artificial intrusion into a natural ecosystem, hunting?
Because hunting's always been a part of that ecosystem. Hmm. Since time immemorial, with the tribes, right?
Yeah.
People have always played. And so if you look at it, bison have actually been managed, you know, quote unquote, managed by people, whether it was the tribes lighting big grass fires to move the animals, hunting them, you know, having a low take and kind of being that main predation force against bison or on bison. And so in that sense, hunting absolutely plays a big part of the ecosystem, because people are a part of the ecosystem. You know, these things aren't one or the other. Human beings were there. And so American Prairie's idea is that if we have a highly regulated hunt, you know, out here, then absolutely we will mimic what the tribes did, you know, 200, 300,000 years ago.
So what do the tribes think about all of this?
I don't want to paint the tribes with a broad brush necessarily. Tribal councils are absolutely for it. There are some ranchers that are also tribal members that don't like it. But far and wide, or I would say mostly the tribes are – tribal members are for it, because what American Prairie Reserve is doing is they're bringing back bison, and not just on a small scale. This will be the largest wild herd in the lower 48. And that is a huge part of the Ani and Nakota culture. The tribes and the bison were braided together for a very long time, relied on it for everything. In my story, you know, we talk about how hooves were ground into glue, and how bladders or stomachs were used to haul water. You know, a bison's coat is so warm that when snow falls on it, it wouldn't melt. And so, you know, you use that for warmth and for your teepees. So when they lost the bison, they lost a huge part of themselves. So that coming back is pretty exciting.
Kenneth Tuffy Helgeson, he's a Nakota tribal member. You talked to him in the piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't expecting to talk to him. I was set up to talk with a different guy, and I went to this powwow. And you just see him, and he's got this big, broad hat, really nice white, crisp shirt, young guy, braids, and everyone was like, you got to talk to him. And as a reporter, sometimes you talk to people and it's really hard to do an interview, right? And they ramble and they go off on. This guy was just, and he wasn't practiced. He just knew how to tell a story. And it was probably a 15-minute interview. And it was just, sometimes you get shivers, you know, when you're talking to people.
Yeah, I do.
And I got shivers talking to him the entire time. It was a beautiful conversation. And he summed it up perfectly, not using his own words necessarily, but using, you know, the words of his grandfather and of his ancestors to explain to me this white guy running around at a powwow in Lodgepole, Montana, you know, why the bison was so important. I feel bad even trying to summarize what he said, because he said it so perfectly.
We should also point out, as you do in the story, that tribal members are not going to get their traditional land back. They're not going to be the owners of this land. But that doesn't bother Kenneth Tuffy Helgeson.
Yeah, so I asked him whether he was bothered by the tribes not getting their traditional lands back. I mean, the Ani, the Nakota, and various other tribes had held power over this land for time immemorial. And he wasn't bothered by it. This is what he said.
You know, I believe, my friend, that in our old songs, our old teachings, there's one song that our people sing, and it says, my friend, don't be foolish. The only thing that lives forever is the earth. We can fight over land, we can fight over dirt, we can fight over all these things, but really all you ever have is what's on your shoes. That's the only dirt that you'll ever own. The only ground that you'll ever own is on your shoes, and that'll fall off too. I try not to worry myself about those things down the road, because you'll drive yourself nuts.
So one of the things that we were talking about before is that, as you say in the piece, there's a fundamental difference between working the land and letting it go wild. I want to come back to Connie French, because there's something that she said that made me think about the stakes here for ranching. Ranching is a culture, right? And she said, she told you that tourists are different from people who live in a place.
Right. I kind of threw it back at her when she was like, because she kept saying, like, I don't want to live this land or leave this land. I don't want to live a soft life.
I don't want my grandkids to live a soft life. I don't want them to have air conditioning at a push of a button, or heat at the push of a button, or things delivered to their door. I want them to have to work for some things. I don't want life to be too easy.
At the same time, she's fighting against forces that are much bigger than her. Globalization, increased efficiencies, automation, things like that, you know, that's making it much tougher to make a go at being a rancher. Most especially because it's hard to find people to take over your ranch when you die.
Yeah.
You know, kids don't want to come back and live that hard life with no air conditioning or heating or things like that, you know. So I threw back at her and I was like, well, you know, I live in a city. I lived in Western Montana. I would go on these 3-day backpacking trips, or, you know, big epic trail runs. these wild places are becoming proving grounds for our self-sufficiency. And you know, she said, like, well, then you're a visitor, you're a tourist.
You're an observer. So you're there for a short time and then you come back home. When you actually live there, you're a participant. You are involved in the day-to-day life of not just you, your animals, but the land around you, the wildlife, the grass, the bugs. You are an active participant that's taking care of that place. You're not just observing it. You're not just walking through, passing through, saying, oh, isn't this beautiful? I think there's a big difference, even in sports, if you go watch a ball game versus if you're actually playing a ball game. And I think that's that when you're a tourist, you're observing. When you're working the land, when you're on a working landscape, you're a participant. You're a part of the equation. And I think that's what we are as ranchers. We are a part of the equation.
It was a long, long time that we lived on ranches and farms or in small towns. And what are we losing when we lose those places? You know, what part of ourselves are we losing? And that's, I think, what she's fighting against is not losing that part of ourselves.
So how do you see this progressing, this idea? There's this question that comes up, I think, in your piece of whether the American prairie is moving too fast, and who gets a seat at the table? Is there room for public comment? Are they – I mean, they're buying this land. Garrity told you they feel this sense of urgency. We need to act now. So what's your sense of how this is playing out right now then?
Right now there's pushback. I mean, obviously there's a lot of pushback, but there's also pushback at the legislative level. And so I kind of talk about this in my story, but, you know, ranchers have had control in Montana for a long time. It's a control that's put, you know, them in county commission seats, in the state legislature. And so American Prairie Reserve still has to work with the federal government. Because remember, the federal government owns, you know, a lot of these lands.
Yeah, like 80% or something.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, 80%. They have grazing leases. American Prairie has grazing leases, which gives them a lot of control. But they still have to ask every step of the way, hey, can we remove cattle? Hey, can we put in bison? Feds always say yes. But there's been pushback most recently from the Republican-controlled legislature on wanting to remove interior fences, which essentially opens up to make even more big grassland, where they passed a resolution condemning that. And the BLM just got a wave of public comments of all sorts just hating on American Prairie Reserve and their whole idea. So yeah, I think there's going to be some pushback. I think it's going to be a lot tougher for them in the Trump administration. They got a lot of money, you know? They have a lot of money. Millions and millions of dollars. As Garrity said, he told me, you know, their donors aren't the kind of folks that get hit by recessions or, you know, gamble in the stock market. They have money that goes back decades, you know, to heirs in the 19th century and things like that. Money's kind of king in America, and so I think that they'll build it. I think they'll build it. I don't think anything's gonna stop them.
Hmm. There's this book that was written, it's been around for a while, by Richard Manning. It's called Rewilding the West. One of the things you've mentioned is that, and you say this in your piece, that there's a quote from that book that was, as you put it, rolling around in your mind as you were reporting this story.
Yeah. It was eventually the breaks will break us and teach us to live within their rules. So this area is known as the Missouri River Breaks. It's really, really tough country. Hard, desolate, wild. It kicked off homesteaders. It's made ranching tough out there. We're always trying to work that land. We're always trying to mold it into our vision. That land's always going to be there, though. And I think that's what I took away from it. It's like the breaks will break us. It'll teach us to live within their rules, you know? The land is really in power out there. We're kind of having all these little fights and everything else like that, and these conflicts, but the land will just continue to be there, you know? I don't know if that makes sense, but the land is, yeah, the land will teach us to live within its rules. It'll tell us what needs to happen.
Nate Hedgie, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Nate Hedgie. He's KUER's reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. You can listen to his radio documentary. It's called The Next Yellowstone at KUER.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to our intern, Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.